I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Okay, well, today we're going to go into a really cool conversation that I'm very excited about, but some breaking news. I don't have the audio prepped for breaking news. Actually, you know what? Maybe I do. Breaking news. Oh, Taylor had a baby.
Woo!
So Taylor's not here, and to replace Taylor for the day, we have our friend Kyle from Life's a Wreck podcast.
What's going on, fellas?
Thanks for joining us, man.
No problem. No kids over here. No distractions. That's all podcast all the time, guys. I'm locked in. I'm ready to go.
Yeah. So Taylor had the baby. I don't know. Are we? Maybe I'm. I'll wait. I won't say anything. But the baby is cute as fuck. I'll say that.
I think you're allowed to say
that because that's a spoiler that I can give.
I gauge whether or not we're allowed to say things based on Taylor's wife Kyla's Instagram post.
Yeah.
And she said the name of the baby.
I'll just leave for Taylor to say it on the show.
So we can, if you want to know before Taylor comes on the show and tells
everyone. All right, fuck it, I'll say it. They named the baby General Custard. And she's so cute.
GC for short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, and the whole family's doing good, and we're really stoked that there's a new little sweetheart in this world that's going to be spending lots of time in the studio, I'm sure.
Thank you.
But that is not why we're here today. Today, we are gearing up for a conversation with our friends, Dr. Mike Lang and Christy Wolf. And I mean, in the conversation, we'll get into it all, but basically these two are wizards in the realm of digital storytelling. Specifically, they're really good at the art of digital healing. I was really excited about this conversation because I came to learn about the work that these guys are doing through common language digital storytelling at a conference, and we speak about all that in the conversation. But it's really neat to see people doing sort of what we do with this podcast, but they're doing it from like a much more professional sort of like standpoint with like research behind it.
Yeah.
And it just kind of made me feel like, hey, look at that. That's cool. We stumbled into this. Like,
here's your headline. Sick boy, no research.
Yeah. Zero research.
You know what I don't think they thought about though, is that like every time I hear the name Christy Wolf, I think that it should be immediately followed by a howling sound. And I don't think that that's part of their intro on their podcast. But maybe we should consider adding like a Christy Wolf. Oh!
Would a wolf with an E howl?
Probably not.
Yeah.
But like most people listening don't know that her name is spelled with an E at the end.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do everyone a favor and just go right into the episode so we don't have to talk about that anymore. You're going to start a howl, Brian. Stop it. Folks, enjoy this lovely conversation with our friends, Dr. Mike Lang and Christy, and we'll see you on the other side. I'm not going to say more. I'm bubbling with excitement for this one.
Me too.
Because, for a variety of different reasons, but...
me too. I was feeling like
you were left out there?
I started to feel like I was being rude by not contributing my excitement as well.
It's okay. It's just part of your personality.
Well, this is what I'll say. The reason why I'm excited, I think will become quite clear pretty early on, but it's not every day that we get to have guests on the show that that are like very much within the same wheelhouse as us, but from a far more like
professional.
Yeah.
Is that the word you were looking
far
for?
Far more legit and like dialed in version of what it is that we do. But that's the part that gets me excited, because by learning about what our guests do, I came to realize that there's a whole world to what we do that I don't even think we really had a grasp on. So I'll leave it at that. And if you'll give me a moment here, I'd love to introduce our guest today. So today we are very excited to welcome two very exceptional guests who transform personal experiences into powerful narratives. Okay. Just listen to the intro and just see, like, just does this sound like us? Okay. Dr. Mike Lang, a health researcher and filmmaker. We just lost it. Fuck. A health researcher and filmmaker specializes in using digital storytelling and documentary filmmaking to educate, advocate, and heal in health and wellness. He founded Common Language Digital Storytelling, focusing on global facilitation of digital storytelling. We're going to get into Common Language quite deep today. And alongside Mike, we're also joined by Christy Wolf, who is a photographer and a digital storyteller, who brings her personal experience as a medical mom to her work, helping others document and share their health journeys. Through her lens, she aims to make visible the often unseen struggles of triumphs of those navigating medical challenges. Today, we are going to be diving into the aspects of the significance of storytelling in health, and that's kind of the part where we fit in.
I see what you did there.
Where these guys fit in comes from a very much entrenched in the science behind that, which I'm so fascinated to learn about. So without further ado, Christy, Mike, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. And I know I gave a brief little introduction there, but please give us a little bit more insight into who the two of you are and sort of how you found yourselves doing the work that you do.
Thanks for having us. Yeah. Mike, why don't you start?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing. It's definitely not a career path that like your high school guidance counselor chooses for you. You know, this it's a bunch of basically saying yes to a bunch of random decisions, random things over my life brought me here. But really, actually, I should share it. It all started with my own cancer diagnosis when I was 25. And as part of that process, to sort of heal from that, actually, I realized I needed to connect with other people my age who'd had cancer. Mm. And ended up convincing 8 people from across the country to go on a kayaking trip with me. We had a buddy of mine start a film company. And I asked him to come down the river with us and create a film. And it ended up being 10 times better than any of us thought it would be. And so we actually did the old school travel across the country in an RV film premiere thing. And we shared the film at every single major cancer center in the country to doctors and nurses and in services and grand rounds and stuff. And no one had ever showed a movie at grand rounds before. And so people showed up and it was amazing. The conversations we had after the film where people would stand up, you know, like 20-year oncologists would stand up and say, you know, what I learned from your story was, and it blew my mind because I was like, how the heck is anyone learning from me? I'm 25. I've met 8 people with cancer, you know, how could you be learning from me? You know? And that's sort of when I realized, man, I think the healthcare system needs, more stories, or actually in that case, you know, better told stories in a way that people can really glean wisdom from them that they can apply to their own healthcare practice. And so that's what tipped me off to this idea of storytelling in healthcare. And I'll leave it at that for now. But a bunch of other random things got me to the PhD end of it and where I am now. But yeah, I'll throw it over to you, Christy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think finding Mike happened like probably 8 years into what I was doing. So my son was born with congenital heart disease and scoliosis. He was a NICU kiddo. And when we were there, my background is an educator and I'd been kind of learning a little bit about photography. And I really started taking a lot of photos in hospital of our experience. And someone at the hospital said I wasn't allowed to do it for other families. And I was like, yes, I am. I will figure out a way to do this so that I can photograph other families. So I ended up photographing families through Ronald McDonald House, like in hospital for about 8 years, just as a volunteer, one family a month. And really talking about what it was like to be in hospital with your kids. And so at a conference, I came across somebody who had done a story with Mike, and they showed me their story being there. It was a series he did where he created a digital story with a caregiver, and then did like the whole work through the process. So you saw him working with the caregiver, then you saw the story, then you saw them sharing it. And that person was actually at the Children's Healthcare Canada conference where I met Jeremy. So it's kind of a full circle. So I started working with Mike around digital storytelling, telling my own story, and then working with other people to tell their stories.
Christy, I'm really curious about that moment of you taking photos in the hospital. You know, we've spoken to hundreds of people who have spent time in the hospital, and you know, it oftentimes is a very scary situation being there. I feel like a lot of people would initially think like, oh, I don't want photos of that. Like it sounds, you know, like I don't want those memories. Why would I want to look back at photos of like the scariest time of my life? Why is it important for you to take those photos?
I just found that I needed something to focus on that wasn't just like the medical language. Our son was born 8 weeks early. And so we spent 54 days in the hospital right at the beginning. And I needed something to do, like other than just holding my kid. And it just kind of gave me something to do in the hospital. But then later, when I was looking back at it, it really helped me process through some of those things. And so I do agree. Lots of people aren't comfortable taking photos in hospital. And it's kind of like, if you are, take those photos. I also didn't usually ask for permission after that first time. So it was a bit more of like, okay, well, I did this thing and I won't show other people's faces. But like, this is important for like showing my son. We have a book about his first heart surgery at a year that like he can go through and see all of those pictures and ask those questions now when he's 11. And so I think that often we don't realize how much of like growing up with something chronic health is like a huge part of your identity, and having the access to look back at what that is really important to me.
I am just to something you mentioned, Mike, at the very top there about your personal experience with cancer and wanting to connect with others who have been through something similar to you, especially like as a young cancer survivor. You know, I feel like there's quite a bit of like isolation and feelings of like loneliness, like almost like there's, you know, is it just me? Like, am I the only one here going through this? And, you know, when talking about the work that we've done with Sick Boy, you know, when we were doing the show, this all started as like a kind of as like just a fun sort of joke between pals. Right. And it didn't take long for us to kind of wrap our heads around the fact that these conversations that we're facilitating are like, you know, they're acting as a form of therapy for the people that are within the conversation. But it's also for the three of us, it's become this like this way of feeding this curiosity that we have of like the human experience of living with illness, no matter what that is. But it wasn't until I took part in a young adult cancer survivor camp called Athletes for Cancer. Camp Koru is the name of the camp, and they lead like surf camps for young cancer survivors in Maui. And they brought me along to just kind of like help run the camp, be a camp facilitator. And at that point, I think we had been doing the show for maybe a couple of years. And when I showed up, one of the aspects to that camp was like every night, all of the survivors would sit around a campfire, and we would encourage conversation between everybody there. And it was witnessing the power of that sharing and those conversations where it really dawned on me like how vitally important those types of moments are for people who have been through something so extreme and so, you know, so devastating, and finding that sort of common language between each other and that connection between each other. So I'm just kind of curious, like, what was the, you know, when you decided to do this on your own accord and bring these people together and go on this like kayaking trip, what was, you know, did that, was that an idea that just kind of came out of nowhere, or like where did that idea kind of generate from for you?
Come from? Yeah. Well, you know, before I was diagnosed with cancer, you know, I was a ski patroller in Whistler in the winters. And in the summer, I'd run adventure trips with inner city kids from Seattle and Tacoma. And we'd take them on this exact same river. And man, you seeing these kids sitting around, you know, literally, you know, little gangbangers, you know, in training, essentially, you know, coming out there and seeing the nature and the conversations we would have sitting around, like you said, the campfire at night. It blew my mind. And so that's, you know, so I knew I wanted to do that with people who had a similar experience to me. And you know, actually, you know, this is back in the day, you know, you probably know First Ascents, you know, mm-hmm. and Camp mm-hmm. Kuru and Brad mm-hmm. Ludd and those guys, you know, I actually ended up starting a charity called Survive and Thrive Cancer Programs. And we ran for 10 years. We ran this charity where we do adventure trips every summer, four or five mm-hmm. of them every summer with young adult cancer survivors. And man, I think really that is what that's where you get trained in to understand and to witness and to sit with people and listen to stories and understand what they're saying. You know, those campfire conversations, I mean, it's something we've lost a little bit mm-hmm. in our culture, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's so cool you got to witness that, you know, mm-hmm. And it's not that you need, and it's so cool you guys get to do this every day. Right. You know, essentially yeah. that's what you're doing. You're sitting around listening to stories. And, you know, with common language, we do these things called kitchen table nights. And it's the idea that, you know, we used to sit around the kitchen table and tell stories. And that's the way wisdom got passed along mm-hmm. to the next generation. And now we do it, you know, virtually in podcasts and things like that. But it's the same idea, right? We need to pass this wisdom along. And it's a wisdom that can only come through listening to the stories of others and actually caring about what they're saying mm-hmm. And listening well to what they're saying. And so yeah, it's you know, there's all these overlaps between you know, what you experienced at Camp Kuru and what people need more of and what you guys are doing with Sick Boy. So yeah,
can I jump in and just say because the kitchen table nights, I want to explain that a little bit. Mike gets a group of people who have told digital stories, so we actually watch the digital story. And then there's conversation after. And so if you have an opportunity, definitely sign up and come watch one of those to get an idea of what digital storytelling is. It gives you an idea, but it also involves you in that conversation.
Yeah, you get to be a part of it. Yeah.
Can you explain digital storytelling? Like, what is digital storytelling?
Sure. Do you want me to take this one, Christy?
Go right ahead, Mike.
Okay. Yeah. You know, this digital storytelling is something that started with personal computers back in the 80s. You know, they realized, wow, you know, with these little computers, now we can actually create films. Everyday people can create films. Mm-hmm. You don't need all this fancy video equipment anymore. And so they started doing this down in Berkeley, California in the 80s, where they'd bring people together and they'd record a short story and then put images and sometimes video together using this very basic video editing software, and they'd add music to it. And so digital storytelling, you know, unfortunately, they chose the wrong name because now digital storytelling could be anything. It could be Twitter. It could be, you know, Instagram Reels, you know. So but it's really this sort of I would call it a genre of filmmaking that's where people create their own films, right? And they choose their own photos. They write their own story. They record it. We help them through that whole process, but they make it themselves. And that's what's so super cool about it, right? Because, you know, I do a lot of documentary stuff too. And when you film people, and then you're actually telling their story for them. You're editing it together. You can, in a very, you know, scary way, you can make them say whatever you want. and so digital storytelling is so different, right? It's like, what do you want to talk about? What matters to you? You know, what image do you want to use here to represent that experience of illness or injury that you're talking about? And so it's really this process of helping people craft their own short films, using whatever they have, you know, and luckily now everyone has one of these guys in their pocket. And more and more when I work with people, they're like, yeah, I do have a photo of my 20-inch abdominal scar. I think I'm going to put that in my story, right? Because they carry around these things. And so they can really use a lot of their own images, or they can use stock images to tell the story. But yeah, it's democratizing this filmmaking process is really what I would say is awesome about it.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I would say one of the things that I really think about too is that sometimes people will be like, I don't have a story. Or the other end of the spectrum is like, I have so many stories. And one of the things that Mike and I do along with the rest of the common language facilitators is like help them figure out what the meaningful moment is they want to focus their story around. So not like when we think about going to healthcare providers and we're telling like chronologically, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. We're actually getting them to focus on a moment that they want to talk about and then building a story around that.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I would love to just kind of get a little bit of insight into, you know, at what point did this, you know, this experience that you had, Mike, of leading people on this adventure to share their stories, and then, you know, from there, like, at what point did this become something that you saw as a gap in the healthcare system? Like the, you know, this idea of digital storytelling or allowing people to like share their story from the patient perspective, like at what point did you see, oh, okay, you know what? This is not something that is typically happening within healthcare systems. And this is something that could be beneficial. Because I know that you have on your website, you have like 19 peer-reviewed papers. And I'm sure not all of them are pertaining to this exact thing. Maybe they are. but there's quite a few in there that literally, you know, that literally dive into like the importance of storytelling within the sphere of healthcare. And so like, when did that click and how did that begin? And like, you know, where did all that work kind of generate from?
Come from? That's a great question. I think going back to my cancer experience, you know, I was a young, excitable, belligerent 25-year-old running around, I was running around the cancer center telling people what they should do. And eventually they said, all right, Mike, why don't you just be a patient advisor on this committee? And they threw me in the room with like a bunch of oncologists. And here I am, you know, 25 years old, being like, what am I doing here? You know, like, why did you? I sort of, you know, threw myself in the fire there. And, you know, and I started, you know, that was the first time I was a patient advisor on anything. And I started to recognize, you know, that people were actually listening to what I was saying. And I didn't know why. And I didn't know what they were getting from it. And I was like, man, there's something here, right? Like, and I could tell when I would share a story from my experience, it would sort of land with the audience, right? And they'd all be like, you know, or, and the conversation would change directions. It would get much more deeper in tone. And I was like, man, there's got to be a way that we can bring more patient voices into these, you know, everyday clinical conversations. So I started running, before I even heard that digital storytelling was a thing, I started working with a group called Wellspring, to help cancer patients, create little short stories about their lives. And then I would take them and show them in my advisory meetings. I'd be like, hey, we should watch this story. And people would watch it. Then we'd have like a 20-minute conversation about it. And we would totally change the way that we were planning for this new cancer center in Calgary, right? And so that was the first time that I was like, maybe this could be something that we should do with more, you know, patients and families. This is a great way to get their voices embedded into the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it was a researcher who approached me. She said, Mike, I love your digital storytelling work. And I was like, what's that? And she said, oh, it's what you're doing with all the cancer survivors. I was like, oh, great. Mm-hmm. And she said, you should be my research assistant and help me make digital stories for a research project. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And this is after I'd finished my master's in health services research, because I wanted to understand the healthcare system better, because I knew there was something happening. I didn't understand these conversations. I couldn't follow. And so I did my master's in health services research. And then after I was a research assistant on a couple projects with her name's Dr. Catherine Lang at the University of Calgary. She sat me down lunchtime and we drank a couple glasses of wine at lunch, because academics do that. And she convinced me to do a PhD in the Faculty of Nursing, actually. I have no nursing background, but they were like, we want to explore stories and digital storytelling in healthcare, and we want you to do it. And so they convinced me to do my PhD.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that.
Is there any like kind of quantifiable like measure in how a story, like I feel it when we sit down with people and we talk about their experience, like you can kind of feel it in the moment that there's that it's like a positive experience to just be sharing your story. There's a cathartic nature to it, the ability to go back and listen to it, all that. Like, is there now that's sort of qualitative and not quantitative. Is there any quantitative nature to being able to say, like, you know, when somebody expresses themselves in like this sort of way, there is this like takeaway benefit that you could quantify in some measure, or and whether that's on the patient or whether that's like on the administration side, because it sounds like it's what you're doing is really crossing boundaries between like the kind of like administrative aspects of like how hospitals function, or how centers function, and how people kind of feel about their experience.
To that question, like there was one of your papers that specifically related to behavior change in patients, and I guess maybe this is a valuable thing to bring up here answer Taylor's question, but I guess like. It, you know, would that be an example, like behavior change in patients? And to that end, what is behavior change in patients? Why is that important? And I guess, like, how can this process help cultivate behavior change in patients?
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, here we go. That paper you're referring to, you know, that was looking at sort of a framework for how you can use stories to change behaviors. And so it doesn't actually have any quantifiable direction, you know, there, apart from, you know, here's how we could potentially use stories using these different behavior change sort of frameworks. So, but, you know, when it comes to actually changing, you know, patients' and families' experiences, I would call that, you know, stories change people's beliefs, attitudes, and values. And beliefs, attitudes, and values are the necessary sort of precursors to behavior change. And so we know that, right? And here's the thing about it. You don't need any fancy numbers to quantify this. We've done this since the beginning of time, right? We sat around, we told stories, and that's how people developed their belief systems, right? And the things that they valued and the attitudes they had towards life, right? It came from the stories that they were gathering. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this later. Christy and I do some stuff in East Africa. And, you know, they call them fireplace conversations, and their grandmother would gather them around and she would say these two magic words. And then the kids were like, OK, she's going to teach us something now. And then she would tell a story. Right. And so we know that that's the way that stories operate in the world, is they change beliefs, attitudes, and values. And so the difficult part is, how do you tie that in a quantifiable way to the behavior change? Because there's so many things that are happening. I don't want to get too nerdy about this, but I think just to bring it back to what you guys are doing, you know, when you give people a chance to tell a story in the way that you do, it's what's called a sense-making activity, right? They're making sense of this very difficult healthcare experience that they are that they have been thrown into. And man, those sense-making opportunities come around very rarely in our day and age, I think, you know, and digital storytelling is one of those, right? When we stop and we say, what's a meaningful moment in your life related to your cancer diagnosis or your cancer experience? Most people have never thought about that before, right? And that process is just so powerful, because they're like, yeah, what was one of the most meaningful moments for me? And then, you know, the follow-up question we ask them is why? Why was that meaningful? And then they're like, wow, yeah, why was, when that nurse said that to me, why was that meaningful to me? And then at the final question is, what could that moment be saying to you? What piece of wisdom is embedded in that moment? And then all of a sudden people are like, wow, I think it shows that she actually cared about me as a person and not just as a number, right? And so they start to make sense of these very chaotic and unformed healthcare experiences as they tell the story, as you ask good questions, right? And that's why this is therapeutic for people, right? Is you're making sense of life.
It's kind of like it reminds me like a far more important and valuable version of like how when you even if you have thought about something and you've thought about it and you think you know what you're thinking about or how to think about something, but then once you write it down on paper, it actually like just the simple act of writing it down makes it solidifies it. It makes it tangible. It's there. Mm-hmm. It's like tactile in a way. And all of a sudden it makes way more sense in your brain just by writing down what you've already thought about and already know. Mm-hmm. And when you share that, like, you know, you have a story and people might be very, very certain about what their story is, but until somebody says, "What's your story?" and it actually comes out of their mouth, it hasn't taken on the same like life yet.
That's like one of the reasons why therapists are so, you know, or a lot of time, you know, therapists are encourage the idea of like writing your thoughts out as opposed to just like thinking your thoughts, because by writing or even speaking them, you're activating this part of your brain. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs. I can't get nerdy about this.
You're regurgitating what your therapist told you.
Yeah, basically it's like you're activating this one part in your brain that helps you process that information in a way that is valuable, as opposed to keeping the thoughts in. It doesn't give you the faculties to be able to really sort of distill what's happening in here. And so by speaking it or writing it, it completely transforms the way that you relate to it, right?
I think of how for a lot of people, when they think of writing things down, it can be, you know, overwhelming if they don't think of themselves as a good writer. And Chrissy, I'm curious from your perspective of taking photos. And I think of, you know, your son who is born, and then you were taking these photos of him, and now he's growing up. I'm curious if like those photo, like how those photos play a role in like having that conversation with your son as he grows up and is able to start understanding some of these things.
Yeah, well, I also think about like when a photographer comes in and takes a family set of photos, right? They often will put it together with a slideshow to music, and you just see like image after image, similar to how Mike was talking about. When you're creating a documentary, you're telling the story. So I felt like I was telling the story as a photographer. And that's part of why the digital storytelling stuff really made sense to me, because now we have words to it. I have a story about my son. It's actually about a bedtime routine, our bedtime routine of like, what are you grateful for from today? And then it ties in the whole medical experience. So it uses all of those photos from back in the day in the NICU and like shows what our life is like. That video he has shown to his class, like to talk to them about what's happened in his life. And I share that with his permission, but it's been shared at healthcare conferences with physicians and with cardiologists. And like the same thing that Mike was talking about with like the cancer experience and the oncologists and thinking about what people took away from that story that they don't see in a 15-minute clinic visit, right? They learn so much more about what it's like to live with that condition or for the family and including the siblings. And so I think that when I start a digital story personally, and often when I talk with people about it, like I might not start with the words. I often will have an image in my mind of the story and a particular like the front of the children's hospital emergency, right? Like that vivid image that sticks out in your mind. And then I will start to build a story that way. Also, a digital story is only about 200 to 400 words. Mike would argue 300 to 500. We differ there a little.
There's a range.
And so it's not a lot of writing, right? And it can be just in conversation that you're getting that information, because we write differently than we speak as well. And this is a spoken narration. Like you are reading what you wrote if that's how you choose to do it. I do actually want to throw this back too to Jeremy, because he saw a presentation about, I brought two digital stories with my colleague, Christina McGuire, who also does digital storytelling with us. They had been created in a workshop with 6 adults with congenital heart disease. And we brought those to the Children's Healthcare Canada conference. Jeremy, what was it like watching those stories and being part of the conversation at that conference?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest with you, like when that conference was I was there to speak to my experience in transitioning from pediatric care to adult care. And that was a part of like a sort of pop-up of the conference. And then, you know, the official Children's Healthcare Canada conference kind of launched the day after. And I was like, I've got some time to kill, waiting for you guys to come out to Vancouver. And I'll like go sit in on some sessions. And I think the first session I sat in on, I was sitting there and I was like, I have no clue what's happening. This is all so over my head. It was just all research talk and you know, I mean, I might as well have just gone to a class on a completely different language. Like it just didn't connect at all. I thought it was cool and was there. I was going, maybe this will click in 2 years. Who knows? And then Christy, you were like, you got to come to my, presentation. And I was like, all right, I don't know if this is gonna land, but I'll come and hang out. And that was the moment where I had this sort of it was the moment where it completely transformed the way that I looked at what we do with Sick Boy, where I went, oh wow, not only is what we are doing something that like brings us joy, but it's also something that is deeply meaningful for the people that participate in this with us. And there was one story that was one of the digital storytelling projects that was shared there that like cracked my heart so wide open. It was about the young man who was waiting to hear about, I believe, a heart transplant. And he got the call that they had a heart ready for him. And this was an unexpected call because I don't think they were expecting to hear anything anytime soon. And he shares this story about how he receives this call and his like primary caregivers were his mom and dad. And they were away on vacation. And the doctor's like, hey, we've got this heart ready for you. You've got to make your way up to Edmonton or something. It was out of the way. It wasn't where he lived. He had to travel from, was it Calgary, Chrissy? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were like, you got to come from Calgary to Edmonton. We're going to be able to do this like stat. And this is, you need to make a decision like now. And this young gentleman was like, my parents are away and I don't think I can make this decision on my own. And I don't think I should do this with them not here because I don't feel safe. I don't feel comfortable. Like I need my support system there with me. And so I'm going to have to turn this down. And the doctor, of course, was like, please don't do that. Like this is such a huge opportunity. And I really like implore you to just think about this really clearly. And so he talks about having to, you know, make this decision. And was it his sister that sort of chimed in with him? Yeah. So his sister ends up having a conversation with him, is like, look, we can do this. It is okay. Like I am going to be there for you and we're going to like make this happen. And he just shares this like process that he went through in his mind to make this really, really huge decision for him. And as much as he did not want to do this without the support of his parents that were there for him, you know, this entire time, he finds the courage to make this decision to go, you know, on his own with his sister in tow to help him with this journey. And it was like, you know, again, this is all in the span of four and a half minutes. And the room is like brought to tears. Everybody is just like, just jaws drop to the floor. And it was all narrated by this one young man, all supported with these beautiful images of him and his, you know, where he's from and his family and, you know, these other images that sort of support this narrated story. And it was fucking beautiful. Like it was just so profound. And there was like, you know, afterwards, everybody kind of had like a little session to speak around the table. And everybody at my table, you know, everyone was just kind of like really struck by the profound sort of lesson that was taken from this young man's story, again, shared in just a matter of minutes, of how sometimes life gives you these massive decisions that on the surface seem like maybe they aren't the right ones to make, but all it takes is like a little bit of courage, a little bit of encouragement to take the step into the unknown and trust your, you know, trust, like put, you know, put your trust out there to the people that care for you and the people that are willing and able to like help you. And yeah, it was a really beautiful, beautiful experience of just taking in that story. I don't know if that answers your question, but like that was the thing that just stuck with me where I was like, yeah. Holy shit, this is fucking,
it sounds like beautiful. from hearing you say that, Jerry, like it sounds like it makes it feel like even though there was encouragement, and like support from other people, it still feels like that person in telling that story is the one in control and making that decision,
yes, right.
Which feels like a really empowering narrative because it's one that's easy to forget when you're like in that situation and go, well, I only ended up doing this because my sister told me that she would come with me, or like the doctors really encouraged me. But like, it feels like, and maybe reframing is the wrong word, but like that there's this like, just in putting it in that mm-hmm. those words, that it feels more like it, you're in control. Yeah. Is that part of 100%. What's happening?
Well, and yeah. I just wanted to say, so that story is public. The storyteller's name is Vittorio, Mike, you know Vittorio. And he told that story. It starts off with like a phone ringing, and it's like this really jarring effect that he decided to use to grab people's attention right off the bat. So if you want, you can have that link to put in your show notes. I talked to Vittorio about the fact that we're coming on this podcast and that Jeremy, that you had seen his story. And so he was open to sharing this as well. So people can have a look at that digital story and kind of get a sense of what it is. But I don't know where I was going with this, friends.
I feel like hearing that whole, that just everything over the past several minutes of going through that story, like I think the thing that is like, that stands out to me immediately and is because it's so involved in what we do is like the cathartic nature of doing that as like a person who has that story. But then on the flip side of that is like the value in what you said, Jer, about being at this conference and being like, whoa, this was like, all this stuff is like way over my head. There's all these researchers talking about all this stuff. But then you go to this thing that's like very human centered. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that like at a conference that you have something as powerful as that like human aspect involved in it, so that researchers and people who can, I imagine it's not that hard to get to find yourself divorced from the meaning of what you do when you get so in the weeds of the academic nature of what you're doing, or the statistics of what you're doing, or the running of the hospital, and forgetting that like, you know, the administrator at the hospital that's like sending emails and making schedules is actually like a cog in the whole system that's keeping people alive at the end of the day. And hearing those stories, from that perspective, how that can reinvigorate or just remind people that the thing that they're doing is a part of this like thing that needs to happen in order to make people's lives better, and like on so many different levels, mm-hmm. of like the 100 people that I'm sure are involved in a heart transplant, or mm-hmm. the doctor on the phone going, oh wow, like I'm getting this is an interesting perspective to hear that there's hesitation to get a heart, which I'm from his perspective, he's probably like, no, you take the heart. Yeah. You take the heart. Yeah. But there's this like, but I'm feeling this way because I'm this age, or my caregivers and all, like there's so many angles to it that are valuable.
Yeah.
It's really
like
wild.
The angle from the patient, the angle from the family, right? And you know, how they played a role in that, but also from the caregivers, it's like, like, for example, my partner Kira, she showed up to that session in the middle of the session, and she watched Vittorio's video. And after we were having a conversation up in the hotel room, and she said something that just like really struck me, or I went, that's really neat. Where it was, you know, she's a nurse. So she's spent 7 or 8 years in the CVICU as a nurse, the cardiovascular intensive care unit. And that video for her, it was like a moment for her to go, oh, right. Like I've been doing this work for so long that sometimes you forget the that these patients are like have these stories. These patients aren't just patients. And I, you know, I'm not saying that to like throw any healthcare provider under the bus, because you
it's
know,
just
your,
what happens.
Your work is your work. And that's just what happens. Like you are in a place where you are seeing so many people going through so many horrifyingly hard things, whether that's decisions or, you know, traumatic events. And if you want to do that job and do that job without, you know, completely collapsing under the pressure, you have to remove the humanity in some degree in order to keep yourself in that space. But I think oftentimes that unfortunately comes with the element of humanity removed that's so important and vital, which is remembering that this is, you know, this person isn't just the person that's laying in this bed. This person has, you know, they have aspirations, they have dreams, they have family, they have friends, they have opinions. They are a full-fledged being that comes with so many sort of elements that make them who they are. And oftentimes patients are just seen as patients. And so I guess with that said, I would love to kind of dive into the work that Common Language Digital Storytelling is doing in leading facilitating trainings for this type of work to occur within the healthcare system. You know, we've talked a lot about the importance of sharing these stories and the importance of doing it for the patient or for the family, but you guys are actually, you know, going into health authorities and offering training so that you don't need someone like yourself, Christy, to go and do the work. It's like you, the nurse, or you, the social worker, or you, the, you know, if you've got the time, physician, can, you know, facilitate these digital storytelling sort of products yourself for your patients. So can you guys give us a little bit of like insight into how that works and what's the response there from, you know, health authorities and hospitals?
Mike, before you, because this is a good question for you to take, but I just want to tie this back to as well. We've just been talking about patients and caregivers telling stories, but our healthcare providers, we look at them and think this is their job, they need to do this, but there's always so many things going on for them. I am really embedded in the cardiology world. I have a congenital heart kid, but my dad was a cardiologist who died by suicide in Vancouver Island. And so I have worked with a cardiologist there to tell her story of burnout, of what that looks like from the physician side. So this isn't just a way to bring patient and family stories forward, because I think it's a phenomenal way, instead of putting a patient on stage and asking them to tell their story in front of an audience that they're not debriefed about and they don't have like any conversation going into it. This is one way you can do that, but it's not just for patients and families. It can be for anybody that wants to like share their perspective, because there's a lot going on behind the scenes in Canada and across the world for healthcare providers. And what does that look like as well? Because I think that information is also really helpful to bring forward. Okay, that was a segue. Sorry, Mike, talked about common language.
No, that's fine. No, I love this conversation. I mean, this is what it's all about right here, right? And, you know, often what I share, just to respond to what all you guys have been saying, what I often share with people is that, you know, a digital story doesn't tell us what to do, but it tells us why it matters. And that's what you guys are talking about here, right? You know, healthcare providers don't need any more advice about how to do their jobs, but what they do need is to remember why they're there in the first place. And that's what a story like Vittorio's story can help people do. I'm here because of that person, right? Mm-hmm. All this data that I've been learning at this conference matters because of Vittorio. And one other thing I love about this, Jeremy just retold Vittorio's entire story. I don't know how many months ago that happened that you heard it.
Yeah.
But it's amazing, you know?
Yeah, like, I mean, it really did. It really did. Like, it stuck with me. Like, it's a story I'll never forget. And And what's funny is, like, I didn't even think about how much that stuck with me until you asked, Christy, and these guys can attest. I have a fucking shit memory. I can't remember a goddamn thing, but for some reason that just stuck.
It stuck.
Yeah.
You told a whole story, right? Literally, like word for word, you know, like not word for word, but you know, you remembered all the dates and the locations and things like that, right? And it shows, you know, this is why stories actually matter when it comes to something called knowledge translation, right? Actually changing beliefs, attitudes, and values is best done through stories. It's also the best way to share health data with audiences because people like Jeremy can remember, right? And all these healthcare providers, they can remember, right? And so these stories really, you know, we've heard from all over the place. These stories are what stick with people long after the conference is over. And so, yeah, anyway, so all that to say, you know, common language, it was really sort of started because I was running all these workshops and I needed people to help me. And I was like, damn it, you know, like, where am I going to find people to help me do this? And I was like, well, I might as well start training them. And also, I feel like it's sort of a responsibility because I got a pretty big CIHR scholarship for my PhD. And I feel like the taxpayer paid for my schooling, so I should give back to the community. So I was like, I better start using this, all this stuff that I've learned over the past years of school to help get this out there more. And so, yeah, now we've trained all sorts of people all over the world. A lot of them come from healthcare backgrounds. You know, sometimes they're advocates, sometimes like Christy, you know, who have a personal experience, social workers, you know, some nurses, you know, we haven't trained a doctor. Oh yeah, we have trained a doctor.
We have
actually. Yeah, a couple doctors, you know, who are now, you know, they're going out there and creating digital stories,
cool.
You know, and using them to start these meaningful conversations. And you can see, you know, that, you know, Jeremy's talking about the conversation around his table. Man, the best thing about a digital story is the conversation that it starts. They're meaningful, they're powerful, they're memorable. And so people are using these skills now to work in their own communities. To tell stories that matter to them. And I think one thing that I'll mention that's really cool is we're doing a lot of global health stories. I just got back from Uganda last week where we trained people from five different East African countries to do digital storytelling in their own small communities. And it's so cool to see people, you know, literally going out to, you know, creating digital stories about maternal health and then going to a village and hanging a bed sheet from a tree and watching a digital story about maternal health and then having the village leaders having these conversations about it and using that to literally change the way that they do things and saving lives, saving kids' lives, saving moms' lives using a short story that was created in their local language. And so, you know, you can see, you know, the power of this sort of democratization process. It could be used in so many different ways to improve health. And that's really what common language is all about. Storytelling is a common language. It works everywhere in the world. And so what we're hoping to do is give people those skills so that they can go out and tell their own stories and help the people around them tell the stories that matter to them. So, yeah, I covered it over there, Christy. Christy's the one who tells me if I miss things.
So let me jump in for a second. So I would say too, just so that people know that there's different ways of doing digital storytelling. So there's level one. When Mike trains level one facilitators or when I train level one, they're going to work on co-creating a story. So Brian, you and I would sit down, I would support you to tell your story. Level two facilitators are doing it in workshops. So 6 to 8 participants, each of the storytellers is creating their own story, but they're doing it in a group setting, which I think is incredibly powerful for having more conversations around like what that looks like. And I think bringing people across perspective. So Mike's done lots of different workshops where it might be a certain group of people. I've done workshops where it was all, example, congenital heart disease, adults with congenital heart disease. But if you had like a healthcare provider and a patient and a social worker, like thinking about bringing cross perspectives, I think the conversation that could happen from those workshops is just like an incredibly powerful tool for furthering what people are doing in quality improvement. Mm. And then the third level of common language is training facilitators to train other people. So there's different levels, there's different approaches to how you can go about doing a digital storytelling project. All of that stuff is on the Common Language site. And I mean, reach out to Mike or I if you have questions about how to do it, if you want to become trained, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what is the like response been? You know, like you go, I mean, how often are you going into, whether it's hospitals or going into like, you know, the administrative sort of spaces of health authorities and pitching this sort of idea and how, you know, how often is it like a resounding, oh fuck yeah, this is awesome, we need this? How often do you guys run into, we just don't see the value. Like we just don't see it. Just curious about like, you know, what the overall sort of response is from negative to positive.
Yeah. You know, when I did that first film tour I told you guys about, I literally spent the first 5 minutes of every single screening trying to tell people why stories mattered. And and now I would say that's getting less and less, you know, like people are starting to realize, wait a second, we need to hear from the patients and families that we're working with in order to deliver the best care. And, you know, these principles of patient and family centered care that you'll hear, right? You know, that's becoming a little more like embedded into everyday clinical practice, and people actually want to hear from patients and families. And so I would say it's getting easier and easier to pitch this type of stuff. And to be honest, I don't pitch anything anymore. People come to me, right? And they're like, we saw a digital story. We want to make those for our project, you know, or, you know, we've got this quality improvement initiative that we're trying to do. We need some stories to help change people's beliefs, attitudes, and values in the healthcare system. You know, like they come with their ideas already. And really, I just sort of have to help them through that process of making them.
It feels like, you know, like we've been on the conference circuit for the last few years, and it always seems like at the conferences, people are talking about how to engage patients, or at least they're asking the question.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, exactly. And they don't know how to do it. And so like, this feels like a really tangible solution to a big problem that they have. And like, you know, whether 100%. it's building a new center, or whether it's just trying to engage with patients in a better way. It seems like this is a really great way to do that. And like, I think of, it's funny, we started in the last couple of years on our Discord server posting the, we have an episode discussion channel, and after an episode releases, we usually will ask a question about the episode in that episode discussion channel. And then oftentimes people will start sharing their own stories of similar experiences. 100%. And it's really cool to see the sort of knock-on effect of like what one story when talked about afterwards can bring up for a whole different set of people and how they relate to
conversation.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a conversation, man. I think, you know, that's the most powerful part, right? When you give people a place to share a story that matters to them, people respond in kind. They start sharing their own stories because, you know, stories are common language. We see each other in the stories that other people tell, you know, and you know, when we do it in a good way, people, they have to respond. They have to respond. And so healthcare providers, they watch these digital stories. They don't have a choice to not respond anymore. You know, they have to have a conversation. They have to be brought into this. And man, it's incredible the conversations that they have based on a little 3-minute story. And so, you know, back to the question of, do we need to convince people of this anymore? You know, we show a couple digital stories. That's all the convincing they need. Right. And they realize, wow, we need more of this. We need to have more conversations about patient and family experiences and healthcare provider experiences too. Right. So, yeah,
I know that this is not going to be the first time that we get to sit and chat about the amazing work that you guys are up to. And Mike, I just want to, you know, I feel like this is a separate episode, but I'd love to just kind of give people some insight into the work that you do, as well as like a filmmaker, directly with your work with Caregivers in the Wild. It's a project that is like, it's the coolest.
Coolest thing ever.
I've been talking about it a lot recently, and every time I explain it to people, I'm like, it's kind of like Sick Boy meets Man versus Wild with Bear Grylls.
That's a great description. I love it.
But if you would just would love to hear, like, you know, what is the project, sort of, you know, how did it begin, and if people are kind of interested in checking it out, where can they go to find it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, just Google Caregivers in the Wild. I mean, I guess no one's come up with that idea before, so it's pretty easy to find. We're the only ones out there. You know, the idea behind it was, you know, based on that very first film I told you where I used to run. Oh, look at that. There's a video where I used to run those adventure trips. And then I ran them with young adult cancer survivors for 10 years. And then I was like, man, what about the family caregivers? Because we would always encourage family caregivers to come on our trips. And man, they would have these transformational experiences because they always thought that their story didn't matter, right? They didn't think that they had anything to share. You know, it was the person with the illness. That's the whose story. So when I would sit with caregivers, I'd say, what's your story of this? They would always start telling the story of the person they were caring for. And I was like, man, we need to spend some time with these people, help them know they have a story too, that matters, right? They are the backbone of our healthcare system. Without caregivers, it will literally collapse. And so so then I pitched the series to TELUS, and basically we go on adventures, and we talk about caregiving, and there's all these wonderful metaphors that you can develop between these adventure mm-hmm. activities and the caregiving parts of people's lives. And yeah, super stoked. Jeremy will be joining me this summer on a trip. And I found out that he is also a paddleboarding like aficionado. He's got his own paddleboard and everything. And we're going to be doing some paddleboarding together, paddleboard expedition together.
And you guys and have so the I'm coolest super gig ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very cool gig. For folks who are interested in that, again, please go check it on YouTube. It's very cool. And I think we're going to have Mike back on to talk in depth about Caregivers in the Wild and things mm-hmm. that have kind of come up throughout that experience. And I'm so glad that you've offered me the opportunity to come and experience something like that, because it's just beautiful. Yeah. It's really cool. And speaking of really cool and beautiful, I mean, the work that you guys are doing, it's just, again, like it's really, really neat. And I think for, at least, you know, I'm going to speak for the three of us, but I think for us to see people coming at this from a research perspective and really looking at how this is not just something that can be beneficial by living on, you know, whatever your favorite streaming platform podcast, audio mm-hmm. platform. Like this is stuff that can exist within the healthcare system, and it is mm-hmm. having a deep, profound effect on patients, families, you know, the researchers, physicians, the healthcare professionals, mm-hmm. and then the audience alike. So it's like, it's really cool mm-hmm. to see the work that you guys do. And I'm so glad that you've taken time to sit down and chat with us, because again, like, we love doing this work, and to see people like yourselves do this from a little bit of a different perspective is just mm-hmm. it's just so neat.
If somebody's mm-hmm. listening to this right now and they're a patient or someone who feels like they have a story and they want an outlet to tell it, how can they go about finding ways to create their own digital story?
Well, I think we have a couple different things. So one of the things I would mention is that Common Language has a podcast called Leading Through Stories, where we bring on a facilitator to talk about a project that we're working on, and then we bring on a storyteller who has created their story for some purpose that they're thinking about. And so you can kind of get to know a little bit more about what it is that goes into storytelling. And then I would say to reach out to Mike or I or Common Language. We can kind of just connect with you, float ideas about where you might find funding for this, because it is a in-depth process. Like, I tell people to think of creating story in 16 to 20 hours. That's not like a quick turnaround, but running a workshop or getting a story, if you have an organization that could fund that and then have a purpose for that story, those are some things to think about. But we have a ton of ideas of how you can get that started.
Sweet.
How can people find Common Language at Digital Storytelling? How can people find you guys and the work that you do?
Yeah, Common Language DST on all socials, and then commonlanguagedst.org. That's how you can connect with us. Hopefully Amazing. That's simple. Yeah.
Pretty simple. I love it.
Yeah, okay, good. Not always the easiest person to connect with, but Christy is very easy to connect with. So.
Well, thanks again, guys. This really does mean the world to us, and this awesome. Was a real treat.
Awesome. Yeah, for us too. I mean, we've been a fan for years, and you know, whether you realize it or not, you know, you're doing the same work, right? And having the same impact by opening these conversations, by spending time around your little coffee table there with people, it makes a big impact. And I think together, all the different creative aspects of talking about health and wellness, they're together. We're going to make probably, I'd say, the biggest difference when it comes to the way that we have these conversations, the way that we support patients and families in the future. So thanks for all the work you guys are doing. It's been fun to watch.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, there you go. That was, wasn't that sweet? They're just so sweet.
Very sweet.
And again, folks, highly recommend you go check out, their work, especially Mike's work. The Caregivers in the Wild is fucking sick.
It is.
And I'm so stoked that I get to be on it.
And I forget the who was the other person that we were speaking to?
Christy?
But...
What was it?
Oh, Christy Wolf?
Oh!
Secondhand embarrassment is like my least favorite feeling.
How can you have secondhand embarrassment when the first hand person isn't embarrassed?
Or is sick as fuck.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's a whole Reddit channel dedicated to it just called Our Cringe. Nothing like it. All right, so let's jump into something that I'm curious to talk to you guys about, especially you, Kyle, because I think this is kind of something that's very much in line with Life's a Wreck, which is your podcast. If people aren't familiar with it, go check it out.
Thank you.
Awesome. You do a great job.
Appreciate it.
Podcast all about mental health.
And I was actually a guest on Life's a Wreck.
So was I at some point.
Eventually, it's coming up.
Yeah,
we'll have to go back and do like a poll, like Battle of the Sick Boys.
There you go. Yeah. So last night, I'll ask you guys this: Are you guys familiar with the Dorito theory?
No,
can't say I am.
Maybe if you describe it.
Yum, yum. Of Cool Ranch flavor on a chip.
This is crazy.
New Cool Ranch flavor Doritos brand tortilla chips.
That's a sick bag. Dude,
that's
design.
Such an old commercial.
Yeah,
Cool Ranch dip. So the Dorito theory
Was probably nuclear.
It's an emerging critique aimed at explaining why people might find themselves addicted to social media. Not just social media, but like all things that are sort of like unsatisfying. So the theory, which is popularized by a person on TikTok, obviously, draws an analogy between consuming foods like Doritos, which offer only temporary pleasure without lasting satisfaction, and engaging in certain behaviors that don't provide meaningful fulfillment.
I know why.
Empty calories.
I feel like I saw something about this recently, not on TikTok, but does it have to do with evolution and like...
No, you're going way deep. This is like, I think this is very surface level. It's just like,
I think
just
this...
comparing social media or excessive drinking or, anything like that to Doritos. It's just like it
short-term pleasure.
Yeah, you're just like a dopamine blast. Like,
I thought the eating thing with like empty calories or like calorically dense meals was an evolution thing that came from, you know, in the past we were like starved for calories. And so because we were hunter-gatherers and had to like go out and try to get our food, and it would sometimes be difficult to get that food. And then, you know, once we would get those meals, we would just eat a lot. Now that food is readily accessible and we can eat a lot whenever, we're still evolutionarily trying to stack calories to like, you know, build body weight so that we can survive in harsh conditions if there's no supply of food.
Right. Okay.
But that's not this theory.
Do you want to just go down that road?
No, I think this theory is wrong though, based on what I know already.
And you might as well howl while you're at it there, Brian. So this TikToker, Celeste Aria, points out that similar to the brief enjoyment of eating a chip, the peak of experience with social media or other addictive behaviors occurs during the activity itself, not in the aftermath, leading to a cycle of continuous engagement without real contentment.
Okay, I feel that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So the concept is applied to explain the addictive nature of specifically like infinite scrolling on platforms like TikTok, or, you know, if you use Instagram. Personally, I don't have TikTok, but like Instagram Reels, you just end up scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. It can be applied to like excessive drinking or staying in a toxic relationship. I mean, that's something, if you've ever been in a toxic relationship, you know that there's something kind of keeping you there, you know, and like, and it's like
the spike of the good times.
It's like, exactly.
It's bad solo, but then you get that little bit of good and you're like, ho.
It's these peaks and valleys and there's something so.
Give me more of that.
So the Dorito theory, Aria emphasizes that recognizing these patterns as a part of the Dorito theory helps to avoid such addictive behaviors, suggesting a broader applicability to others struggling with similar issues. So the comparison between social media and substance addiction is not new, with numerous studies and experts highlighting the negative impacts of excessive screen time on mental health, including anxiety, depression, poor body image. The concern is particularly acute for young people whose susceptibility to internet addiction has been shown to decline with age. This has led to a significant advocacy from parents and interventions from companies like Meta, which have introduced features to mitigate harmful effects on teens, such as reminders to take breaks and efforts to, you know, limit exposure to damaging content, which I find interesting. And I think for, you know, for like Meta to incorporate those things, I think a part of that is a response to, ooh, yeah, we know what we've done is like bad.
100%.
And so we have to like, we have to add this.
Try to do something.
Yeah, exactly. So that we don't really get like burned.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Band-Aid on the bullet hole. It's like you built the bazooka and then you're like, oh, we'll also like put the tiny little warning. We'll put the warning label. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And like, this is good enough, right? Like we just did this. This is good. Yeah. Okay.
So the core concept here, just like kind of like understand more of the core concept. You've got temporary satisfaction versus lasting fulfillment. Okay. So the essence of the Dorito theory is the distinction between fleeting pleasure and genuine satisfaction. So much like snacking on chips provides a momentary taste of delight without real nourishment or lasting satisfaction, engaging in endless social media scrolling delivers quick dopamine hits without substantial fulfillment.
Oh yeah, it does. Man, guys, I'm addicted to my phone in like a bad way.
Yeah.
It's funny because I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
And I know absolutely. I feel empty time, like time that should be like even this morning. So I woke up early this morning and I would either be sitting on my phone scrolling, like drinking coffee.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even when I got up and I couldn't look at my phone and I was going to make breakfast, I would put on a podcast. Like there's always some sort of stimulation happening.
Constant. Yeah. I'm the exact same way. Also, I'm not sure if you guys do get this as well. When you're scrolling and you've scrolled for probably 30 minutes and you click your phone off and you go, I don't remember a single thing that I just saw.
Nothing
stuck. It was just throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and just your brain just being like, I guess I'll take that.
What do you think you use on your phone? Like, what app do you think you use more than anything else?
Instagram.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah?
And it depends. Like right now it's YouTube because I was recently on a number of flights too. And I that's like full consumption the entire time.
Yeah.
I download
YouTube videos and stuff.
Yeah. And I don't remember how I dealt with flying, especially long haul flights, like pre being able to download.
Yeah, I'd have like that safety videos. Packet. You have to like memorized.
You have to go to the bathroom and jerk off like on a long haul flight like five times.
It's funny. Do you think
somebody's going to the Mile High Club? It's me
on my own. It's funny though because I think of like I'm not sure if they put magazines still in the seat pockets on the plane.
Porter does.
I don't remember seeing
Porter magazine is pretty sick. It's like here's all the cool stuff in Canada.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's this restaurant in Montreal you should go to. You're like, okay, why not? Sure.
But I don't even look at that stuff anymore because I just have my phone and I'm like constantly dialed in. Like I bought the internet on my plane just so I could watch new YouTube videos.
Yeah. Well, here, how about this? I want to show you guys. Okay, so the reason I brought this up is I had a conversation with Kira last night. And I think I've talked about this on the podcast a little bit. But over the last few months, I've gone through quite a like drastic transition in my entire, like in my life entirely. So like, but like in particular pertaining to my mental health. Mm-hmm. So like my mental health in November of 2023 was like fucking tanked, like low, the lowest it's been in a long time. And so I needed to like seek intervention right away. And I got on medication and, you know, I was diagnosed with depression and started treating my ADHD and doing some like lifestyle changes and my life has completely shifted.
Yeah, dude, you went from living life like Steve-O to living life like Andrew Huberman.
Yeah. Yeah. Like actually. Yeah.
Like really, really.
Okay. So here's an interesting little kind of like observation.
First of all, good for you.
Thanks. Yeah. An interesting observation that I had was that over the last like couple of months, I've noticed that not only did I cut out alcohol, not only did I cut out THC. Mm-hmm. But I also, and this was, and like those were things where I said, I'm going to stop drinking. I am going to stop eating edibles. But I also noticed that I didn't stop, but I really lowered the amount that I was using social media. Mm-hmm. So like my Instagram usage was like really low and I was noticing it. And like, I'm having all these
hard.
Well, no, like, it, so here's the thing is I think that it was literally just a byproduct of like getting clear in my head. Mm. And so I was lacking this need to like pick up my phone and just fucking doom scroll. And the part that I found really interesting was that it wasn't something that I noticed until I thought about it. And when I thought about it, I went, whoa, fuck, wow, I'm actually seeing there's a ton of time that I've cut out from doing this thing. Mm-hmm. Yet I still do it, okay? Yeah. So I haven't cut it out entirely. But last night, I just said to Kira, I was like, hey, I'm gonna delete all my social media.
Crazy.
And she was like, what? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to stop using social media. So like, you know, for work purposes, obviously I can't like delete my Instagram account. Mm-hmm. But what I mean is like, I'm going to delete the app off my phone. Mm-hmm. And the only way if I'm going to use it is to open it up on a browser on my laptop.
Ew.
Right. And the only reason I would want to do that is not to actually look at Instagram, but to just make sure like if I, you know, if a good bud like messaged me or something that I could say, hey, I'm not on here. Just shoot me a text. Mm-hmm. And I think I can do it. I know it's probably going to feel weird and hard, but I think I can do it. And so we were talking about this last night and I asked her, let's look at our phone usage and like compare it.
Is this why you took our phones right before this?
So let's look at your guys' phones.
Oh, thank God.
I have mine too.
This is a bad saw my week. Browser open and my heart dropped.
So what I have here is I took two shots. I took weekly usage and weekly pickups. Okay. So this is... This is all. Everything we see here is based on the weekly average of use.
Yeah.
Okay. So Brian, people can't see this, but what we're looking at is Brian's weekly usage, which is at about 4 hours and 48 minutes per week, which is not that bad. Like that's not crazy.
Yeah. This is down 50% from last week, though. Too.
Right.
Right. So
on
a
regular like week where you're not because you were in Finland for 2 weeks.
I was actually using it more in Finland because when I would go to bed, I was jet lagged and I would stay up scrolling because I couldn't fall asleep. And part of the reason I couldn't fall asleep was that like increased use. But like, also you'll see here and just like I know you're going to take us through the stats, but like my most used apps are YouTube and Instagram, which essentially account for like all of my usage, and YouTube is like about 50% of that, which I was watching tons of videos.
Your Instagram usage is and this again, this is the weekly average, is 4 hours and 25 minutes. Okay, so let's think about that for a second. Over the span of a week, and this isn't even like a like this isn't even an accurate, so it's probably even higher than that. Let's round up to 5 hours. Over the span of a week, 5 hours on Instagram. Your YouTube is 5 hours as well. So let's say 10 hours of utilizing apps on your phone over the span of a week. Now, this is typically happening like, okay, it's going to happen when you're taking a shit. Obviously, everybody's on Instagram when they're shitting. But it's also going to happen, you know, maybe during your morning coffee. You're scrolling Instagram, or maybe it's going to happen, you know, in between meetings and you have like 15 minutes and you pop open Instagram, you're on there for 15 minutes or fucking whatever. 10 hours in a week. What are the things that you could do if you didn't have access to that? What are the things that you would actually, let me ask you this. What are the things you think you would do in replace of this? If this got taken away from you, what are some examples of things you would do with 10 hours over your week when you have downtime or nothing to do and boredom kicks in?
Maybe I think probably the most profound one, if I'm like honest with myself, is like spending more time with Maddie at home.
Yeah.
You know, like, and
phones
I think
away, just
And I would also say part of that is like, you know, at home, when I'm at home and she's studying or writing a paper at night, I'm like looking for something to like do. There's a lot of like work and side project things I could probably be spending that time on doing some of that work. I also, I want to be careful about this because I don't think I take enough downtime. Like maybe the answer to that is like actually doing nothing.
Yeah.
And,
right. yeah.
and I think that that could be a really important usage of the time. I think the areas of my life where that probably causes the most trouble is like, you know, would I spend more time walking Rupert outside? Like, do I sometimes shorten my like walks with him because I'm like, oh fuck, I just got to get back in and finish that video or like do, you know, X, Y, or Z.
Okay. I'm glad you said that because so one of the things that I was kind of like looking into when I was thinking about this over the last couple of days is like, all right, you have the phone, which you're picking up and you're going to your, let's look at your pickup. So you're doing on weekly, daily average of picking up your phone 169 times.
Oh, I didn't know they tracked pickups. Oh, mine's gonna be
what's
brutal.
That like? You know, like in terms of like averages, is that a lot or is that?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't feel like that's super high maybe, but I don't know. I could be wrong.
That's, like these
Jared,
numbers.
Is yours in here too?
Yeah.
Okay. So
we're all going to go through it.
These numbers don't feel like that doesn't feel bad to me. Sure. 169 for
again, pickups? You have to think pickups. You know, we use our phones for work a lot. Like we're not, you know, we are tied to our phones for work in a big way.
Sorry,
like,
this is the daily average.
This is your daily
average. So 169 times a day.
A day.
Fuck. That is maybe more than I thought, actually.
It's a lot,
A lot of wrist action.
So here, so I was thinking like, okay, so when we do this, these are digital experiences. We are going for digital experience to give us whatever, whether it's dopamine or whether it's productivity, whatever it might be. There's nothing good or bad about any of this. It's just something interesting to look at.
This is a really interesting number, though, because the first used app after a pickup is usually WhatsApp. And so I have a soccer team group, like work related groups and things on that. So like if I'm getting messages, then I'm more likely to pick up my phone if I see it.
That's what I mean. It's like you're not just picking up your phone to like,
I'm not just like craving fucking, the sort of like, look at it. It's likely that there's like a notification.
Yeah, there's stuff. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I am doing that too. I am picking up my phone for the dopamine.
Yeah. So you have these digital experiences.
They're all notifications.
The thing that you said, Brian, was taking your dog for a walk, right? And so like, okay, if we replace digital experiences with something else, what could they be? They could be physical experiences. So walking your dog, I think is like a really fucking prime example. Maybe the walks are longer. Maybe there's more walks, you know, like 10 hours in a week. That's a lot of walk time.
Or even just playing with him in the
house. But you also have things like cooking or reading a book or drawing.
Those are all boring.
Yeah, but well, you know what?
Those don't make my brain happy.
Right. You say they're boring because, again, they don't taste like a Dorito.
Yeah. But, exactly.
But they taste more like a really well-cooked salmon. It's like, they actually do taste good.
Why does that kind of make sense that a book is like salmon? For some reason, that really like fits for me.
So it's like, it's not that it's boring, because it's not boring. When you read a good book, you're not bored. You're actually reading a good book. When you're cooking and you're into it, you're not bored. You're doing the thing. And maybe cooking isn't your thing. When you're walking Rupert, you're not bored. You're walking your dog.
What makes it's a just book not, better it's than not, social
it's
media?
Not, it's not sucking your dick the way a fucking doom scroll on TikTok does.
I think you know. So I just said what makes a book better than social media, and I think it depends on the book that you're reading, and obviously maybe not social media, because obviously social media is
a natural stimulus.
But like for example, YouTube videos. Like most of my content consumption is educational. Like I'm watching a lot of tutorials on design,
but
and
you're
coding
still
and,
tied to a screen.
100%.
Yeah.
But what makes that worse than a book about that same subject?
I'm not saying worse, good or bad. I'm just saying without a screen, there are other things that we can do that bring us joy or bring us whatever the fuck it is you're looking for that don't have to do with a screen. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because when I was addicted to alcohol or when I was addicted to video games, you could tell me, hey, Jerry, you may be an alcoholic, or hey, Jerry, you may be addicted to video games, and you could tell me right to my face, and I would go, literally in my head, my response, whether it's outwards or internal, my response would be, no, I'm not. I know I'm not. And when you hear that you're addicted to your phone and you say, no, you're not, I don't give a fuck what your screen time says. I think everybody who has a fucking phone and everybody who uses social media is addicted.
Yeah.
It's just a level of addiction. That. And so my point is that it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's just a thing to think and consider.
Yeah.
So if you took the screen away, what are the things that you could do that would give you the same kind of things you were looking to have
See, my thing is I incorporate my screen into times like cooking. Like I'll be cooking and I'll have like a show or podcast or some kind of background noise on at the same time and just completely like, I don't know, turn my brain off, I guess.
Well, let's look at yours.
Oh, God. So, this is going to be tough.
Okay. So Kyle, your weekly daily average, 5 hours and 56 minutes on the phone.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, it's higher than Brian's, but like, you know, mine back in November, mine was like 6-7 hours. Right. So like, you know, it's definitely high.
Kyle, yours is also down 24% from last week, but mine was down 50%. So we probably are like similar.
Here's the part that I want you to see, Kyle. Like, and this is going to be uncomfortable. You have a limit set. Brian, you had no limit set to anything. Your limit on Instagram was 2 hours. So you have a limit that tells you, hey, you've been on Instagram for 2 hours today.
Yeah.
Now, even with the limit set, your daily average use of Instagram is 11 hours and 10 minutes.
No, not daily average. That's the weekly
average. Which is like, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot of time.
100%. The reason, so I deleted TikTok from my phone because that was the first thing that I noticed I was spending way too much time on. I kept tricking myself into the idea of I'm going to create content. I'm going to pick up TikTok and create content, and I would never do it. I would just pick it up and I would just start scrolling and then I'd be like, well, I guess I didn't get it today.
Yeah.
and so I deleted that and don't use it at all. And then the second one, as soon as that was gone, it was like, huh, these Instagram reels are tickling that part of my brain that's left over. Totally.
Guys, I can be on YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, or TikTok and not know which app I'm on.
Yeah. Man, it is. We talk about like building the bazooka, like literally how much content is now created for the sole purpose of like maximizing stimulation. Yeah. It doesn't across every app. It's
and
like,
what's it giving
Snapchat
you?
Was like, hey, let's get fucking, you know, quick content in there. Like it's ridiculous.
And that's the thing. It's like, it's empty calories. You're not getting anything from it. So your daily pickups are 104 on average. Mm-hmm. And again, Instagram's like just under your messages. So like lots of texting, but also Instagram's taking up a lot of that. The other thing I find interesting was that your daily usage, you have a lot of Disney Plus time. So that's kind of cute.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big guy. You guys want to know what it is?
Yeah.
While I'm cooking, I'll throw Family Guy on.
Hey, nice.
And I just, and I'm just a sucker for just dumb TV, you know, Bob's Burgers, just, you know.
Yeah. You're an addict. Away. Get fucking fixed, bro.
Exactly.
the one thing I do love
the Disney Plus syringe
is that you had a podcast as your most used after pickups too. So as a podcaster, very admirable.
Yeah, so, let's just focus on that.
So this is mine, 4 hours and 19 minutes daily average. But I'm going to say this. This is actually quite inaccurate because Riverside is 3 hours and 4 minutes. Riverside is what we use to record the podcast.
Right.
And I use my phone as a camera sometimes to record. So 3 hours and 4 minutes, that doesn't actually count. Messages is my first most used. Instagram is my second. I still use Instagram 2 hours and 36 minutes. Over the span of a week on average, which is, you know.
I mean, 2 hours over the span of a week, though, that's like what? 30 minutes a day?
Sure. But again, 30 minutes a day to do what else? Hmm. There's a lot of other things I could be doing. And I don't need to be on Instagram. Like, that's why I feel like really stoked on this idea of just fucking getting rid of my social media. 149 pickups a day, and mostly it's messages. But again, Instagram. Hue lighting. I really love my lighting.
I was just actually saying, what the fuck is Hue?
That's crazy.
It's my lights.
Fuck. So yeah, I mean, the reason why I wanted to bring this up, and again, like I feel like this is one of those things where again, it's like you point out something to an addict, they get aggressive and go, "Fuck you, I'm not." Which, like, if you're listening to this and you're having that sensation, I'm not saying that this is a. I'm not saying this is bad or good.
We're saying your reaction to this is bad.
I am saying that there is a difference between mindless consumption and mindful consumption.
Yep.
And I think most of us are mindlessly consuming.
100%.
And I think that if we just start to be a little bit more mindful about the way we consume, it could have some like really fucking radical sort of shifts in our life. I watched a video of a guy last night, young guy, 24, and he was like, I cut out social media. I want to tell you what it was like. Mm. And the thing that he said that really stuck out to me was, you know what this feels like? I feel like a kid again. He was like, do you remember times when you like were at a cottage or family cottage or something? And like you were looking for things to do. And so you would like play a board game or you would go on a scavenger hunt.
You didn't have your Sega Genesis.
Yeah. He was like, you know, I feel like that again, where it's like, I'm, you know, the other day I asked my family to play a board game for the first time in fucking years. Like, I never do that. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. Right. Yeah. You're like, you're going to go to the park and just like, go look at trees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or mindlessly consume trees through your eyeballs.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly. Post Big Brother. That was the biggest thing. I've talked openly about how Big Brother, there was a lot of like downswings to my mental health. The one thing that was like the most incredible thing was
right.
How disgusted I was with my phone. Yeah. Like this so visceral, like, ugh.
For people who don't know, you were a Big Brother contestant.
Yes.
Which is one of the things ago, that yeah. sort of sparked your desire to start the podcast about mental health, because your experience on Big Brother was actually quite taxing on your mental health.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. The podcast had, been rolling for a little bit, but then Big Brother really was like, oh wow, this is a super unique mental experience. But the phone thing, not having access to your phone because this is probably less consumption than I was even before Big Brother. And then handing somebody my phone and not seeing it for 60 days for 2 months was like...
Yeah, he lost 60 days.
Yeah, it would have been like 90 days. Yeah, and that would have been even better. They were like, here's your phone, loser. Yeah. Like, welcome back to the addiction. Yeah. but that was just like, that was the best. Literally how clear-minded and how just looking at life, like... You didn't get bored. Yeah. There was a period of about a month post show where I didn't get bored at all because I was just like that part of my brain that just was like stimulate me. Yeah. It was just like not there. It was just chilling.
Like that's the thing. Like when I stopped drinking alcohol, there was a period of time where it was fucking hard.
Yeah. Oh, the first like little bit, I just almost like.
But then the funny part was like once I got over that hump. It was like 2 months later, I went, oh, whoa, holy fuck, I haven't been drinking. Like, you don't even realize, you know, it's like once it's gone and you get over the hump of like the fucking like insatiable need to fucking like fill. Yeah. Once that's gone, you actually forget. And then once you make the realization, whether it's through conversation or through therapy or whatever the fuck it is. Then you start to see all the ways that it's kind of changed you.
Mm.
And I think that. In this idea, again, back to this idea of mindful consumption, even if you just incorporate that or challenge yourself to incorporate that, I think that would be enough to like get you to a point where you start to see the world a little differently.
Totally. And for anybody who wants to read a good book on this, Joanne Hari's most recent book, Stolen Focus, is really about this topic.
Cool.
And
sweet.
It's really, really, really fascinating.
Let's get him on to talk about
that. We absolutely should.
Yeah.
And don't read his book. Just listen to the audiobook.
Yeah.
Download it. It's so much easier to
get ChatGPT, get it to summarize it for you.
What Brian's saying is don't read a book, use your phone.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right. Yeah,
continue.
Exactly.
How the fuck would you read a book?
I do want to say too, Jarrett, I'm super proud of you
for
the journey you've been on because
absolutely
it's been like it's been a huge noticeable difference.
Yeah. People listening aren't gonna like they won't be able to tell because it's like, you know, I'm on it. Me on the podcast, very different from me outside the podcast.
Yeah.
I have an English accent. I fucking
it's crazy.
Thanks, Bri. Like I do feel I feel incredible. And
yeah.
And so now that I feel this incredible, I'm kind of like on this fucking kick of like, what else can I do? You know? And so I'm gonna try this. I'll keep you guys updated.
It's inspiring me too. Like, this is a good wake up call for me too.
Yeah. And to all the people that give me money to post things on Instagram, I don't mean I'm deleting Instagram. I'll still have it. You can send me your shit. I'll still post it.
Send the check.
Yeah, bring that money, baby. I'm not going to be using it as a crutch to fill my time. Okay. We are way over time. This was a long episode. Kyle, thanks so much for popping in, bud.
Hey, appreciate you guys having me.
Sweet.
Always a pleasure.
And folks, thank you for tuning in. We love each and every one of you. And if you are going to try this, if you think, you know, hey, you know, I never thought about this, I'm going to try some mindful consumption, let us know. letters@sickboypodcast.com. Tell us what you think. Tell us how it's going. Tell us if you think that's just a fucking dumb idea. And I'm just up here spouting a bunch of fucking hippy dippy bullshit. I want to know. letters@sickboypodcast.com.
And while you're telling us about how you feel about that, also tell a friend about this podcast because that really helps us get this out into other people's ear holes.
Hell yeah. And starting next week, we'll be back on YouTube full time. So each episode every Wednesday will be uploaded to YouTube in its full video version. Head on over to Sick Boy on YouTube and hit subscribe
so that you get more.
Follow our Instagram. We're putting up lots of posts there. Lots of stuff to scroll through. Go to our Instagram.
Oh, lots of shorts. Irony. We're good. We're really focused on shorts.
And if you want to support the podcast further, come on over to our Discord. Lots of cool people over there. Lots of fun conversations. We'd love to have you. You can find the links to our Discord in all the show notes of this show. Who do you want to thank?
I want to thank everybody for making this show happen. Thank you, Taylor, even though you're not here, and congrats on your new baby. Congrats, Kyla, too. Thanks,
General Jeff. Custard's so cute.
General Custard is really cute. Thanks, Jeff Lonis, our manager. Thanks to Rich O'Coin for the theme music, to Donovan Morgan for the sound design on the show. We love all of you. And again, this is Kyle here in studio with us and Kyle's podcast. If you're just scratching and itching for the next more podcast content to listen to as soon as you finish this one, check out Kyle's podcast, Life's a Wreck.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
This is Kyle. I'm Jeremy. And this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.